Welcome to Holden Village. In the Creekside Room, today's speaker is Kathy Sorrells, and we'll be speaking on engaging in the creative process, the assessment. So let's listen in on Kathy.
I was telling them at lunch or at breakfast this morning that one of the things I thought we might do during the class was to learn how to tango. And somebody said, well, thank goodness you read the creation story. So I thought I'd tell you all that so you'd be have done and compared to what we could have done. We could have been learning to do the tango. Now, I have to explain to you why we didn't learn to do the tango. And that is because I don't know how to do the tango. And I would have had to learn beforehand. Next time.
Okay, that would be more like T-A-N-G-L-E.
Tangle? Yeah, could be.
Kathy, that reminds me of a story about Gandhi. Mm. I just read this week. A mother came to him and said, Mahatma, I would like you to tell my son not to eat sugar. And he came very quiet and he said, bring your child back in 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. So she said, okay. She left and came back in 2 weeks and the child stood in front of Gandhi and Gandhi says to him, do not eat sugar. And the mother says, oh, I'm so grateful, but why couldn't you have done that 2 weeks ago? And he said, 2 weeks ago I was eating sugar.
That's pretty good. That's right. Yes, there is something about teaching people to tango when you can't tango yourself. That's the moral of this class.
Would it be too naive to ask why we were going to learn to tango?
Isn't that self-evident? I mean, everybody else knew. No. Right. Well, it was just that a friend of mine who isn't here right now in the village, but who's a long-term staff person here, and I were brainstorming about things that we might do in this class. And I usually try to do things that use as much of ourselves as possible. So readings and writings and drawing and painting and thinking and using dancing. Your body, dancing. And she does know how to tango. So she said, well, why don't you teach them how to tango?
How about a simple line dance?
Yeah, that might work too.
No problems with line dancing.
Yeah.
Tango.
Did you all dance last night?
Cookie did. She was the star.
All right.
Yes. Oh, it was fun. Great. It was fun. She danced.
Teachers should be up on the stage a little bit so we can all see this. Because if you don't know how to do it, you don't
want to
be in the front row.
Uh-huh.
But if you're not in the front row, you can't
figure out how to do it. That's a little bit of a challenging paradox there. Well, I wanted to share one last poem with you, and I decided to copy it all. And you all are familiar with right brain and left brain things. We started talking about that last night. You know, left brain is very carefully in line and very detailed and covers every space. And right brain is a little bit more broad, sweeping, and just... Right brain, way of handing out things.
Yeah, but how did you identify that? I mean, it's the right brain.
It came to me. It came to me.
Unplanned?
The first time I did it was completely unplanned. I was working as an intern at a big conference, and I thought being an intern meant that I was sort of a faculty person. Well, what they thought what an intern meant was that you made copies and handed things out. And I, a gopher, and for like 5 days I made copies and handed things out. And I just got a little tired of it, and it was boring and stuff. And so the last time that one of the instructors asked me to hand it out, and there were 40, I just said, well, I'm just kind of tired of this, and I just took it. And the instructor was pretty appalled, but everybody else had a good time. So, yeah. So, since, and then somebody there labeled it as a right brain.
I know the but still you haven't put the tag on it. Like, it, is it explosive or spontaneous?
Oh, it's creative.
It's creative.
Well, I was using it as opposed to left brain. It's right brain, which means it's. A,
maybe she's asking the. Are you asking the difference between right brain and left brain? I think everybody understands it totally.
Yeah.
Yeah, left brain tends to be very orderly and in line and very detail-oriented, like I said. So you're going to go through things from A to Z, and you're going to go in an order, a very specific sequential order. And right brain, and these are real generalizations about the hemispheres of your brain and what capacities come through those sides of your brain. Right brain tends to be more broad-sweeping, more global thinking, more... random, you could say. Other
creative.
Well, left-handed people work out of the right side of their brain, and vice versa. I have said that, you know, Michelangelo was left-handed, Julius Caesar was left-handed, and Harry Truman. All three, if you voted for a president in the United States this time, you voted for a left-handed person. And I go along and I include Jesus Christ right in the center of the thing and go along and, you know, people who really are left-handed. I've never had anybody say, was Jesus really left-handed?
How do you know?
My question is, how do you know?
It was how he was holding the plane when he was working as a carpenter.
I didn't know that Michelangelo was left-handed and Julius Caesar. I don't know, you know, from historical documents, I think.
Right. There's actually a drawing. There's a drawing of him, and he's when he was working as a carpenter, and it's how he was holding the plane. See, if you were right-handed, you'd hold it like this, but left.
One of my brothers was left-handed, and he was made to be right-handed.
Yeah.
And to this day, he does the things that he. You know, hammering, sawing, all of those things, all the carpentry things that he gets with his left hand.
One interesting, there's been a lot of research done on this, on people who've had lobotomies for various reasons, and different functions come from different sides of your brain. And in Japan, they did some very interesting research. The language, I don't know if you're familiar with, in Japan, there are two different, or there's three different ways to write things down. There's kanji, which is the Japanese or Chinese characters that were borrowed, and they're very pictorial. It's a picture. And then there's what's called hiragana, which is very phonetic. So it's just a symbol like ours that tells you how to read it. Well, those come from the right side of the brain covers the one that's more pictorial. The left side of the brain covers the one that is more phonetic. And people who've had a lobotomy or had injury to certain aspects of their brain can remember one or the other, but they can't remember both. So that's how they discovered some of the early aspects of which side did what, which part. So. Well,
did your activity get you changed from being a redefinition of intern?
Well, I now teach there. I did, and that was the following year, as a matter of fact. And it was the directors of the institute that I did that. Yep. So, they did. Yes. And I teach there. This is the Summer Institute for Intercultural Communication, and it's in Portland. And that was 6 years ago. Yeah. It's actually out at Forest Grove at Pacific University.
Is there a Pacific Lutheran University in Tacoma?
Tacoma. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, does it have any affiliation at all with this place? All I've heard is St. Olaf and every place else. Nobody ever even said anything about it.
Oh, yeah.
Carrie's behind. You can answer it. I know that Martin and... Martin and Susan were at BLU before they came here, so there's that connection, but I don't think there is. Is Carrie, do you?
No official connection.
Yeah. And there's no official connection with St. Olaf either.
Right.
Is that right?
There's no official connection with anything anymore.
But there's a lot of people that come here and have come here. I was in the same town. I was at Carleton, which is in the same town as St. Olaf, 20 years ago doing my undergraduate work, and I heard about Holden Village there. So, yeah. So, and more, a lot more people know about it in Minnesota than they do in Washington.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. Down our area, a lot of people know about it.
Yeah.
thought it for a long time.
Well, that was all an introduction to our poem. To not take it too heavily, when I handed it to Dorothy as she was leaving, or I think it was Dorothy or Ruth, said, "Oh, this sounds very serious." And in a way, it is somewhat serious, but also I think it also is about life and about living, and also about how deaths are not just at the end of our lives. Deaths are every day. And in fact, as this class ends, that's a certain kind of death and loss. And so in honor of all of that, this is once again by Mary Oliver, the poet of the week. The poet of the week, yeah. And it's entitled, When Death Comes. When death comes like the hungry bear in autumn, when death comes and takes all the bright coins from his purse to buy me and snaps the purse shut, when death comes like the measles pox, when death comes like an iceberg between the shoulder blades, I want to step through the door full of curiosity, wondering, what is it going to be like, that cottage of darkness? And therefore, I look upon everything as a brotherhood and as a sisterhood. And I look upon time as no more than an idea. And I consider eternity as another possibility. And I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy, and as singular. And each name a comfortable music in the mouth, tending, as all music does, towards silence. And each body a lion of courage, and something precious to the earth. When it's over, I want to say, all my life I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom taking the world into my arms. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I have made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened or full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world.
Better read it again.
Would somebody else like to read it?
I would.
Okay.
When death comes, like the hungry bear in autumn, when death comes and takes all the bright coins from his purse to buy me and snaps the purse shut, when death comes like the measles pox, when death comes like an iceberg between the shoulder blades, I want to step through the door full of curiosity, wondering, what is it going to be like, a cottage of darkness? And therefore, I look upon everything as a brotherhood and a sisterhood, and I look upon time as no more than an idea, and I consider eternity another possibility. And I think of each life as a flower, as common as a field daisy and as singular, and each name a comfortable music in the mouth, tending, as all music does, towards silence, and each body a lion of courage and something precious to the earth. When it's over, I want to say, all my life I was a bride married to amazement. I was the bridegroom taking the world into my arms. When it's over, I don't want to wonder if I have made of my life something particular and real. I don't want to find myself sighing and frightened and full of argument. I don't want to end up simply having visited this world.
Thank you.
What age is Mary Oliver?
About 65. Mm-hmm. And this is the collected volume. She keeps putting the same picture on the back of her books, and she looks like she's 35. But she's actually 65, I think. I figured it out from when... Yes, well, she's very real, but it's sort of curious. I mean, it's a great picture, but...
The publisher.
She was born in 1935.
Oh,
Oh, she's not 60.
She's not
60.
She was born in 69.
No. She was born in 1935. She's 60.
60.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's really not very old yet, too. No, it's not.
I think she published some of her first poems in the early 70s, and then sort of through the 80s to now.
That line, when death comes like an iceberg, reminded me of when I had anesthesia here a few years ago. Mm. It really did feel like an internal ice. I thought about that.
Yeah.
Icy feeling.
I like the last line. From a Christian perspective, sometimes you get, you spend a lot of time in heat thinking ahead to heaven, and we're just passing through, and all that we're about is to end it all and be in heaven. Mm-hmm. And I'm not comfortable with that emphasis as much as I am on this, that we are here now. God has a purpose for us in everything we do and say and experience, and therefore, I don't want to. I've just been a visitor either. I'd like to take a part in the world while that's my allotted job.
Right.
I particularly like the line about the I look upon time as no more than an idea, and I consider eternity another possibility, because it's just kind of recently that I've come to terms with eternity.
I think there's quite a bit in here that has really spoke to this week and what we've been talking about in terms of curiosity. And I think the last line brings to me the whole idea of being present, being here now.
Fully
engaged. And you get the feeling with Mary Oliver, when death does come, she will walk into that fully and be present with it as she has been in her life. And something.
Certainly, talking about the light taking the world into my arms really speaks to that. Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks for sharing it with me. What I want to ask and to see if we can share with the full group is how that experience was, and if you feel like you were able to do anything creatively, do anything differently than you might have done before in the interaction. So thinking more about what happened and how you went about it, how you approached it, anything that came up from that you might have gained through the practice that we've done this week.
I'll share one thing about our little group. I guess I shouldn't be sharing it, right?
No, that's it, really.
We ended up with three of us together who don't, I just don't like to share things.
Yeah, why are you sharing this?
This has been the most difficult part for all three of us, because we're not used to this.
Personal.
Frankly, we don't want to.
Who's the third one?
But I had a little problem that I just had to share.
But she had a problem that we could work on.
I think we had an interesting dynamic going, because we each named a problem, and we very unanimously settled the most pressing problem and decided to make that the topic of our conversation.
Well, in our three-man group, we at least each got a quick story told, and then we sort of did settle on one person's account. But I honestly can't say that I can't feel that we applied much of what we learned. I mean, I don't understand this. This is so new to me, this introspective searching and I'm not good at this.
I think you might be better than you think. Yes.
I think that in our group, we've talked about sort of king-size problems, and I'm not going to report on that, but it seems to me that as we try to deal with either small or large problems, we can make greater progress if we can learn to contain a paradox. And instead of seeing these opposite ends as conflicts like this, which they often are, we have to somehow get hold of the fact that this exists and this exists, and we have to hold the whole thing in our minds as we work towards solutions, and that is the paradox. And I think it's very difficult to achieve, but it's a goal worth working toward and trying to deal with the problems.
Holding both.
That probably solves the most. We were trying to solve just one.
Well, that may be part of staying creative or getting more creative is recognizing the tensions and problems which we present pretty well to each other, accepting that that's the way it is, and then looking forward. We didn't have quite have time to solve all our creatively get into it, but that's the beginning of creativity, is looking at the things we elucidated in an overall manner and remembering, yes, we can. We may not be able to do much, but we can keep being educated and keep thinking with an open mind.
And I think maybe not think either or. I think that's what you were saying, Grace. But to think in unity.
Yes.
You know, no matter what kind of a problem it is.
Not black and white, not either or. Right. But looking at the whole picture.
Don't shut your eyes, just be alert to what's
going on. And something will emerge.
There is a similar with doing the pop here, I suppose, to really be alert to where you may change it.
There's a actually, when I was doing my graduate program, we came upon that of not thinking either or, and so we were trying to think of, well, what else can we think? And both and is another way of thinking of it, and I became really conscious of not saying but or in my conversation, and it really made a difference in how I thought. Just try it for a while. When you start to say but, think of and. And when you start to say or, think of, well, both that could be possible. And it's startling how, and I'm sure if Tom were here, he would have some comments about how language can change our way of, or that's what he's been talking about all week, is how language can actually change your way of experiencing and your way of thinking. So.
Like a statement, every now and then you hear somebody, and I'm sure I do it myself, you'd be talking about somebody that you don't usually have much to do with. Like, well, that speaker was a black guy, but he really had a lot of good things to say. You know, instead of saying he's a black man and he had you know what I mean? Somebody totally different from me. He was a very young person, but he had a lot of good things to say. Instead of saying "and,"
yes, that's a very good example. Thanks, Jackie. Yeah.
Our teacher isn't chronologically gifted like we are, but she.
Well, see, you can't have all the gifts all the time. Thoughts on that? Well, I like that. I think my dad would like that. I meant to mention that I gave my dad. I gave my dad this book of poetry last year for his birthday, and last year he was 83. No, this year he was born in 1912. He'll be 83 this year, I guess. And his favorite poem was When Death Comes. He read them all. He read every poem. And He said that was his favorite.
Have you been open to poetry before?
Yeah. No, but he was an English teacher and I think had studied poetry for a while, but he doesn't read poetry very much. And that was new for him to think about reading it again. He does pottery though. Yeah, he started it when he retired, and he actually does not do it anymore. He had a stroke about 4 years ago, and so he's not able to do it. But he just sent me all of his pottery books and said that if he hadn't had a family to support, that he would have perhaps chosen to do pottery, which was very affirming. So.
Kathy, I just would like to share that back to you. That's an important part of the creative thing, was the letting go. The letting go.
Can you be, was there a way that...
Well, I'll speak for myself, that there's a real tendency for myself to want to take charge. You might have noticed.
Yeah.
But that, you know, that there's a need to somehow get things fixed, to really hurry, get things done. My pace is often very fast. And so for me, one of the constant creative processes that I'm constantly dealing with is to slow the pace down, mm-hmm. be reflective, mm-hmm. and to let go. Mm-hmm. And it seems like there cannot be any creativity unless you do mm-hmm. that work first. Mm-hmm. There may be others who have some problems.
Well, I think it's a cultural tendency to jump towards solutions, to find the answer quickly and move on. And I think it has to do with a lot of things, but one thing it has to do with is not being comfortable dealing with ambiguity. And ambiguity is about holding both. It's having two things at once that are conflicting and holding both of them. And our culture is not real good at holding ambiguity. We want to know the answer. We want to get it right. We want to have it done and so we can move on to the next thing. And I do think, pardon?
And we want it now.
Right. Fast creativity. It's like fast food. Let's run through here and let's move it on. And I think the creative process does require a fair amount of letting go and letting the answer come. The other, I think, challenge that we often too in business when I work with folks is that they want to describe the problem too soon. So they've figured out what the problem is before they've really looked at the whole territory. And it is difficult to find an answer before you describe the problem, but that leads you very quickly into an answer. If you say, this is the problem, I'm going to fix it this way. But if you let go and try not to outline the problem so quickly, you're more likely to take in more possibilities. We talk about it as creative problem solving, but the one way that I try to get people to think differently about that is it's creative problem posing. Mm-hmm. So if you can pose the problem in a way, creatively, the answer will emerge much more easily than if you define the problem in the wrong way.
Define a problem in the wrong way, the solution is going to be wrong.
Right. Well, and we... Yes, Ian?
It seems to me that we mostly perceive the problem to be a result of, their... the symptoms. We look at not the problem, mm-hmm. but the symptoms of the problem. Mm-hmm. And we try to fix the symptoms. Mm-hmm. And we don't far enough see the problem.
Right. Which is really looking at the whole picture, exactly, having a more global view of it. And looking at what the underlying causes are, not just the symptoms, but the underlying causes.
I think most environmentalists do that. They want to fix the symptoms, mm-hmm. but not the problem. Mm-hmm.
Well, we've had a long tradition of that. And we could look at it in the medical world, we could look at it in the environmental world, we can look at it in a lot of different arenas where our tendency is to fix the symptoms as opposed to looking at the underlying.
Like with the whole drug war thing.
The drug war.
Yes, we were alluding to our conversation. People with problems with addiction and... why that's a problem
or
the demand.
Yeah, the demand.
And the reason for the demand.
Yeah, right.
Sort of spiritual.
That's a good example.
It is. All of which we could start over next week. with on
probably need to.
Creative problem. I mean, it is, and it, we could do a whole other cycle on. I mean, we did focus more on personal and interpersonal interactions this week. We could then expand that and focus more on how do you use your what we've talked about creatively out in the world, and we could probably grow and grow and grow from that and keep coming back in and out. I don't think the two things are separate. It's you can apply many of the same things, the practices that we've done here, into the larger system.
You know, Kathy, I just recently got off a board of directors where there were like 12 different individuals. We had more difficulty because of the backgrounds and everything. I think if there were people like you throughout the country that were working on a board of directors, that would, I think we'd have a completely different country.
Oh, I'll give you my card. It's but and sometimes though the challenge is that board of directors will call me in and they want me to treat the symptom and they don't want me to treat and they're going to say, well, that's just going to take way too long, Kathy, and I'm getting to the point where I'm saying, well, we need that time and otherwise I can't really be of service to you, and that's where it's challenging to say and to do what you can do, and also for me to let go. You know, I do what I can, but I can't. But I enjoy working with organizations, with boards and things. I think.
But if people would just learn to trust each other first, just to take that shield.
Yeah, there's a lot that has. And that's kind of the approach that I take in intercultural situations with people from different cultural backgrounds, is how do you create an environment where they can trust each other, and then you can talk about your differences. But if you just go in and jump in and start talking about the way we're different, it gets real divisive and angry. And
so how do you create that environment where they trust each other?
Well, I tried to give you an example here.
Say and instead of but.
Yeah, say and instead of but. Yeah, I mean, I do have a whole set of things that I think about creating it. But and I think we'll move on to the next segment.
What is it we're looking for? And you're in some cases constrained by the restriction.
And but it's amazing what, you know, people can say this is what I want and what I can come in and do. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't look anything like what they thought, but by the end we realize it looks. Mm-hmm. And that means they have to trust me.
Right.
To begin with.
Okay.
Which sometimes happens.
Well, I'm basically just try to go on people to begin with.
Yeah.
So they come to you with some trust.
Sometimes, yeah. I think, though, that's a very good question, Frank. And as with most things that are true, I think they're pretty simple, but they're just hard to do. But for me, the basic thing about creating an environment where it's trusting and safe is about respect. And the word respect actually means to look again. Respect, to look one more time at somebody. And I try to practice that with people. So if I, which means not having judgments, which means not having holding on to assumptions, questioning my assumptions. It means setting up a place where everybody, whoever they are, and whatever they bring, is here, and it's a positive force, and that's someone to be respected for who they are. And that's a. It's challenging, though. I mean, this group was not challenging. Seriously. But there are a lot of groups of people, and it's not even because of my personal feelings about somebody. It's the dynamics that are created among people, and the dynamics in this group were incredible. I mean, it's a model.
Why do you suppose that is? Is that unusual for? Is this unusual for an elder hostel sort of thing?
Or
is
it because? Yeah. I haven't ever done
this first thing. Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Oh, you don't know that we're an unusual. You're not saying we're an unusual elder hostel.
No, it's just in my work. I'm not familiar with elder hostels and having done that. My parents have done quite a few of them, and I know they always enjoy the classes and things, but.
I don't know.
I was just wondering if maybe, you know, we're not here as students, we're not here as having to learn this, to do our job better. We're just here because we want to be, and maybe that's why.
That's smart. Well, it does help. And when I was doing, when I first started doing diversity work, a few times I did mandatory trainings in companies. And I mean, that's the worst thing you want to have to do. I mean, to try to come in and turn that kind of mindset around to where people really want to be there, it's just struggle. And you won't get there.
The other thing that we don't have is a history with each other. I mean, I think about the conflict in the churches, and they've built up relationship patterns that are not always healthy. And they have a long history about how things are done and not done. And so you have to come in and have a think in those kind of situations and really deal with it.
You have to come down to the background.
I think the size of this group has been helpful.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. The small size.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Are other elder hostels larger? That does make a big difference. I do workshops for teachers, an experienced teacher workshop. And another thing that helps is a retreat environment like this. Mm-hmm. We do this workshop on Orcas Island in the San Juans, which is a great environment. And it's varied from being 25 teachers to being 40 teachers. And it really makes a difference. The people I work for and that hire me to do it keep wanting to push it up because they can make more money if we have 40 people there. But it's a significantly different quality when you have 25 and when you have 40 people.
But it explains to me something that we have a problem with, me, we being my husband and I, down in our area, the teachers always seem to be running off to retreats for thousands of dollars, which of course we, the taxpayers, are paying for. And we couldn't understand why, if they have a perfectly good school, why can't they do their business there in the school? This tells me a little bit more. Why not?
Yeah, it helps create an environment, a setting.
Yeah.
You don't have to go to Rosario's. And we go to a camp.
I'll suggest that to the board.
Is this to say that the congressman's junkets to Florida is okay?
No.
They should go to camp.
Church camp.
That's better. That's even better. What I'm going to ask you to do now is for yourself. And what I'd like you to do is write a letter to yourself. And then I will mail them in about 2 weeks. So I'll also give you an envelope. And what I'd like you to do is to take the stationery and think about things that you've learned over this week that have been meaningful to you. And just, it's like writing a letter to yourself, reminding yourself what it was that you feel like you learned during this week. And then some thoughts, if you want to write this, on how you might practice some of these, how they might not just have been part of this week, but might come into the rest of your life when you get home.